The content of this program is for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times and National Geographic. And as we talk about these things on today's Armchair Traveler, let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in these articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification, so please keep that in mind. Now, on today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin the journey with road trips where rural America shines. Now, when we talk about rural America, we're talking about primarily the heartland in western USA. This is Elaine Glusak's article. It appeared in the November 4th, 2025 issue of the New York Times. She is a veteran travel writer. We've had many of her articles on the show. She's going to take us this time on a tour of a small town, or small towns, I should say, and agricultural regions that have long been neglected, but today are regenerating themselves through, of all things, tourism. So there you go. So now let's find out what she's up to. When you're road tripping through the cornfields of the Midwest and the livestock ranges in the West, rural America seems endless. According to U.S. Census data, 97% of the country's landmass is rural, occupied by just 20% of the population. Occasionally, motorists might come across a small town enlivened by murals or a busy farm-to-table restaurant. They might find a pizza farm in rural Minnesota or visit a dairy barn in Maryland that serves ice cream made from its milk. These are just some of the ways that rural areas are tapping the regenerative powers of tourism to restore neglected towns, supplement agricultural income, and ensure viability for future generations. Tourism starts at home, said Deb Brown, the co-founder of Save Your Town. Now, this is a website kind of group, and it's called SaveYour.Town. It's a consultancy that works with small towns and rural regions to harness tourism for economic development. You make the locals happy, and then the tourist shows up, she says. Well, let's find out more as we now begin Elaine's tour of these rural areas. We're going to first start in Wisconsin, a place called the Driftless Area. Unlike much of the largely flat Midwest, the Driftless Area was not covered in glaciers during the leveling of its topography as the ice retreated. Though the more than 24,000-square-mile driftless region covers parts of four states, including Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota, southwestern Wisconsin holds the largest portion, where small farms share the hilly landscape with river valleys and limestone outcroppings. Now here, travelers can take classes in wood carving and canning at the Driftless Folk Art or Fish Trout Streams, paddle the Wisconsin River, and hike in the Kickapoo Valley Reserve and Wildcat Mountain State Park. In the town of Baroka, about a two-hour drive on back roads northwest of Madison, the Roble family reopened the 1899 Hotel Fortney in 2023 after 3 years of work to restore its lobby with 12-foot-10 ceilings and modernize 14 rooms, which started at $159 a night. Next door, Driftless Cafe serves farm-to-table fare, featuring ingredients supplied by some 200 area producers. Its owner and chef, Luke Zam, a native of the region, moved back from Madison in 2011 for the food and the lifestyle. You can wander into some really remote spaces in this corner of the world and find yourself overwhelmed by the lack of human intrusion, Mr. Zam said. Agriculture remains a draw. A fourth-generation farmer in Monroe, Wisconsin, Dan Wegemuller, runs the 240-acre Wegemuller Farm with its 60 Swiss, Brown, and Holstein cows. In 2018, he added a four-bedroom rental home, $450 a night, and has continued to develop attractions, including farm tours and a market. Diversifying has helped stabilize the farm's finances and restored his love of working the land. Opening the farm and sharing this inspiring beauty has reconnected me to the rewards of farming, Mr. Wegemuller said. Well, for from Wisconsin, we're going to travel over to Colorado in the San Luis Valley. The world's largest alpine valley, San Luis Valley, covers roughly 8,000 square miles at an average elevation of above 7,600 feet in southern Colorado. Though the region is largely agricultural, its attractions include the family-owned Wolf Creek Ski Area, the lesser-visited Great Sand Dunes National Park, and the quirky UFO Watchtower, where alien sightings have been reported. Now, newcomers have expanded its off-the-beaten-path appeal. 3 years ago, the hotelier, Lauren Coleman, bought a 1946 motel in Donorte on the nearly 2,100-mile Great Divide mountain bike route from Jasper, Alberta, to the Mexican border. With a coffee shop and a retail store, the 15-room Mellow Moon Lodge is poised to attract travelers interested in slow travel, adventure, and small-town hospitality. Those rooms start at about $155 a night. I have horse parking next to EV parking and regular parking, and it all gets used, Miss Coleman said. Near her family's potato and rye farm in Hooper, Sarah Jones rents a 3-bedroom farmhouse as an Airbnb. 2-night minimum stay started around $640, and when her schedule permits, she offers tours of the property, introducing guests to the Colorado-made whiskey that uses the family's Jones Farms organics grain. We're leaning into what's local and showing the people the valley's hidden gems, said Miss Jones. Though a high-end stargazing resort recently opened, the valley is characterized by more modest attractions, including the Frontier Drive-In, a vintage drive-in movie theater with yurts for overnight stays, hot springs, pools, and abundant outdoor recreation, including climbing in the Penate Canyon. Now, we offer that slower pace in open space, said Cale Mortensen. He's the executive director of Visit Alamosa, the tourism office for the county that is the gateway to the Great Sand Dunes National Park. Our traffic jams are usually because there's some kind of wildlife on the road, he said. Well, next we go to Nevada, and it's White Pine County. In White Pine County, a sprawling area on the eastern border of Nevada, a copper mine closed in 1978, leaving 1,500 people jobless and convincing local leaders they needed a more stable source of income. There was a push for recreation as an answer to, hey, we have to diversify, said Kyle Horvath, the tourism director for White Pine County Tourism and Recreation, which covers 5 towns in the area. Though a few mining operations have returned, the county has since built its tourism appeal on adventure, nature, and small-town charm, including a robust public art program. Now, cyclists can ride the Nevada Northern Railway, a working steam train, to biking trailheads. The county now has 50 miles of single-track rails, tails, with another 50 in development. And the annual Race the Rails Even event, pits riders against the locomotive. Now, imagine that one, huh? Well, themed tours include the Star Train, a night ride into the high desert for stargazing. Travelers pass through the tiny town of Baker to reach Great Basin National Park, a lightly visited park that drew 152,000 visitors in 2024, with attractions including 13,000-foot Wheeler Peak, the marble Lehman Caves, dozens of hiking trails, and the endemic bristlecone pines whipped into twisted shapes by weather. Now in Baker, Liz Woolsey runs the Stargazer Inn and Bristlecone General Store with 4 rooms and 3 new tiny homes that start at $120 a night. She organizes events like full moon hikes and cribbage tournaments and offers periodic workshops in subjects like plein air planning. Now, we're one of the most remote national parks in the continental U.S., said Miss Woolsey, explaining the inventory of her store. Our staples, are motor oil, duct tape, and fix-a-flat. And we also have groceries. Well, next we're going to head to Utah in a place called Helper. Now, halfway between Salt Lake City and Moab, Helper emerged in the 1880s as a railroad and coal town named for the Helper engines that allowed trains to make the steep ascent to neighboring Price Canyon. As mining dwindled in the 1970s, the town began declining and owes its present revival to artists and entrepreneurs who saw past the blight to its historic buildings and the scenic book cliffs just beyond them. Mallory DeVincent, a former Helper City Council member and the director of Stay Helper, a lodging business, described Helper in its heyday as a place where 27 languages were spoken and Main Street was filled with bars and brothels. We didn't have the money to mess them up, so a lot of architecture was preserved, she said. Drawn by a low cost of living and dramatic setting for plein air painting, artists began moving in around 1999. One painter, Ben Steele, visited in 2002, then relocated a year later, and now runs Beg, Borrow, and Steal Art Company, a gallery and gift shop on Main Street. You could tell Helper was a bigger town in its heyday that had shrunk, but you could feel the energy of something bigger and a little rebellious for Utah, Mr. Steele said. A Helper transplant, Gary DeVincent, Miss DeVincent's husband, has invested heavily in the town, converting hotels, former filling stations, and other buildings into a mix of vacation rentals, apartments, and retail shops. Vintage Motor Company houses his collection of classic motorcycles and signs in the reopened Newhouse Hotel opposite the Amtrak train station, which offers rooms from $99 a night. I wanted to create a little romantic town getaway, Mr. DeVincent said. Well, in addition to art galleries, Helper offers a brewery and a weekend market. 9 Mile Canyon, 50 miles east, is renowned for its ancient petroglyphs and has hiking and biking trails. Well, we depart from our rural America road trip and now head to the West Coast to enjoy 36 hours in Portland, Oregon. You may recall 36 Hours is an ongoing feature in the New York Times travel section. Today's article is written by Jamie Kotenak and appeared in the August 28, 2025 issue of the Times. And by the way, it includes photographs done by Ruth Fremson. And Ms. Kotenak is a writer based in Portland, Oregon. Portland's reputation for weirdness is warranted. Its annual can't-miss event is a naked bike ride, and local artists turned a dead mall's DMV office into a creative co-working space. But there's depth to Portland beyond its quirks. Its dining scene is one of the country's finest. And next year, offerings expand when the James Beard Public Market opens across 38,000 square feet downtown, championing Oregon food vendors. Its diverse music scene has birthed talents ranging from Everclear to the Decemberists to Anima. And you can climb a volcano without leaving the city limits. Summer is known to be Portland's loveliest season, especially in September, when it's still sunny but the crowds have thinned out. Now, before we begin our itinerary, I'm going to give you a few recommendations and key places you might want to see if you're thinking about visiting Portland. These are from the author. First, Mount Tabor Park's trails scale an extinct cinder cone volcano and meander alongside three reservoirs that once supplied the city with drinking water. Now, in a city besotted with farmers markets, the Saturday PSU Farmers Market is the biggest and the only one that operates year-round. Then we have the many-color-coated rooms in Powell's City of Books, including a rare book room filled with signed copies and first editions, and they hold more than a half million volumes total. Then you get a pass to Cascada Thermal Springs and Spa, part of a new wellness-themed hotel, includes 3 hours of soaking in a silent subterranean oasis. And by the way, to get around Portland, here's some tips. If you'll mostly explore the series of walkable neighborhoods that make up the city, you might rely on TriMet's transit network. That includes the zero-emissions Portland streetcar. If you want to commute like a local, the Bike Town Bike Share program makes it easy to do so. That's the nation's first all-electric bike share fleet. It helps you power up Portland's hills. Cost you a dollar to unlock, then 35 cents per minute to use. Still, for convenience and flexibility, or for travelers hoping to enjoy outdoor adventures further afield, which is, after all, what the Pacific Northwest is known for, the best way to get around is by rental car. Now let's move out and check out our itinerary. Remember, only 36 hours. These are weekend events, and we start on Friday afternoon at Mount Tabor Park at 3 p.m. We're going to summit an extinct volcano. From the airport, as you exit, look up at the undulating 9-acre timber ceiling finished last year. It's a 15-minute drive south to Mount Tabor Park, where you can stretch your legs like a local. A series of meandering trails will wind you slowly up and around this extinct cinder cone volcano, but you can also climb directly to the summit up the flight of 293 stairs that start where the Southeast Yamhill Street meets Southeast 69th Avenue. Those piles of pine cones along the steps, guess what? They're runners marking their laps. Division winds. It's 4:30, so it's time for Thrift and Sip. In the hip Richmond neighborhood of Portland, it's a five-minute drive from Mount Tabor. You might spot a unicyclist in formal attire or a pot-bellied pig on a leash. Also impressive, the thrifting. Now, really good stuff is an overflowing maze of antique musical instruments, vinyl records, instant relatives. These are candid 3x5 snaps of strangers sourced mostly from estate sales, and a whole lot more. The feline face on the shop sign memorializes the late store cat called Tommy. For refreshments, cross the street toward Division Wines, whose rotating menu includes several Wine of the Day wild cards and half-glass pours of anything on the menu for the full-glass price, $12 to $14. Half of the full-glass price, I should say. There you go. Now, if you'd rather have a sweets instead of a sip. A slice of salt and honey pie is $7. Comes from Loretta Jean's. That's a block away. And it will make you understand why there's a line always outside of her store. Now we check out Con. It's 7:30 p.m. and this is going to allow us to enjoy award-winning Haitian cuisine. More than 20 of the city's 500 or so food carts, yes, we call them food carts, not trucks, gather at the Hawthorne Asylum, a lot in the Buckman neighborhood. Mix and match to your taste, from Ukrainian dumplings to waffle sandwiches. For upscale Buckman dining, walk 20 minutes north to Cannes for James Beard award-winning elevated Haitian cuisine. Everything is dairy and gluten-free, and there's an optional vegan menu. If you're a meat eater, try the griot, twice-cooked pork for $24. It just falls apart and it's tender. Considered by many to be Haiti's national dish, it's served with traditional style alongside smashed fried plantains, avocado, and picklets, that spicy pickled cabbage slaw. Now, while mains like the pan-seared striped bass, which comes at $60 a meal, come at a higher price point, they're big enough to share, so reserve well in advance. Well, it's about 10 p.m. on a Friday night. It's time to get on the Good Foot, another Buckman institution. The Good Foot is home to Soul Stew, one of the longest-running dance parties in town. It's $10 for the cover charge. Most Fridays, Eric Hedford, otherwise known as Aquaman, and fellow groove masters expertly spin 45s and other disc from 1960s funk classics to deeper disco cuts for a sweaty, multi-generational crowd in its dark but friendly basement. Well, time to move on to Saturday. Hope you got a little rest there. Anyway, Saturday morning at 8:30, we're going to rise and shine and sweat. At the Elliott's Neighborhoods 26 Cafe, ask for a hazelnut latte from $5.50, made with a house-made nut paste instead of syrup. By the way, Oregon produces nearly all the hazelnuts grown in the United States. A mile east at Bernstein's Bagels, pumpernickel, available only on weekends, is delicious as the bookends of a trout salad sandwich, which is $11. Now, with carbs on board, it's a short drive west to Forest Park, and it's 80 plus miles of trails, perfect for visitors short on time who still want a taste of the Pacific Northwest favorite hobby. Starting from the lower Macaulay Park entrance on Northwest Upshur Street, it's less than a mile to what's known as the Witch's Castle, which served as a ranger station and restroom before suffering extensive storm damage and being abandoned to the moss in the 1960s. And it's a quick and kid-friendly excursion. 11 a.m., enjoy Northwest Best. Get a post-like ice cream cone at Salt and Straw on Northwest 23rd Street, the major pedestrian thoroughfare at Northwest Portland's Knob Hill neighborhood. Creative flavors change monthly. In September, it's apple and cheddar cinnamon rolls, and that's always by popular demand. And then there's a waffle cone for $7.90. Then it's time to shop and enjoy Oregon's absence of general sales tax. Visit Tender Loving Empire, a record label and artist artist market with the brands, vinyls, as well as housewares and stationery. They have an airport kiosk as well. Finally, grab a bike from one of the two bike share docks on Northwest 23rd. That's at Northwest Overton Street or Northwest Kearney Street for a five-minute trip to Powell City of Books, whose four-story building occupies an entire city block, earning its self-proclaimed title as the world's largest independent bookstore. Well, 12:30, and it's time to meander and munch the market. The PSU's Farmers Market, which takes place Saturdays on Portland State University's Green, is both the city's largest and the only one that runs year-round. Now, depending on the season, it hosts as many as 100 vendors selling produce, fresh-cut flowers, and prepared foods. At Verde Casina's tent, everything is gluten-free, and vegetarian options like tofu mole, $27, are satisfying and tasty. Craving a sweeter treat? Well, Orange and Blossom's baked goods start at $5 and $10. They're all vegan, and their flowers are sourced exclusively from Pacific Northwest mills. Many menu items are seasonal. Think peach pistachio tarts, say that one twice, in late summer, or poached apple bostock, twice-baked brioche with apple butter at the approach of fall. Wow. These guys have some menus and items I don't think I've heard of before. Well, it's 3 p.m., so we're going to amble through the Arts District in Portland, the Alberta Arts District, with its rainbow-painted sidewalks and abundant murals, offers an excellent east side counterpoint to Nob Hill. Within a two-block span, you can visit Blind Insect Gallery, which has a multicultural focus and sometimes displays as many as 80 different artists in its postage stamp footprint. Nucleus Portland, whose pop art culture forward sensibilities include anime-inspired art, and Gordino Gallery, where the artists featured in its front rooms are almost always based less than 100 miles away. Now, as you meander east along the Northeast Alberta Street, you'll find plenty of afternoon pick-me-ups. There's Berelick Brewing, a cozy tap house, and a beer garden. Offers alongside its standard seasonal beers and one-off experiments, like late summer's Jess Beach Mexican-style lager, brewed with lime zest and sea salt. And if you want to take it easy, well, a four-ounce pour just starts at $2.75. Well, it's about time to enjoy the wilderness at 6:30 p.m. on a Saturday night, and we join the recreating locals in Alberta Park, just north of Berelick. Some Saturdays, you might even spot LARPers. Now, these are participants in a live-action role-play battling it out with foam swords. After traipsing along the gravel path through its nature patch, an acre of land rewilded with native plants and under dozens of towering firs, leave the park stroll and west along Northeast Killingworth Street to wind up at Farrell, whose all-vegan menu can change daily and regularly incorporates foraged Oregon ingredients like huckleberries and chanterelle mushrooms. Now, expect inventive dishes like the lion's mane mushroom steak slathered in a charred eggplant Diane sauce. This is going to cost you $28. Or you might try the grilled peaches served with savory spice cream, hazelnut salsa matcha, a spicy condiment, and meat and basil all for $14. Now, reservations don't hurt, but walk-ins are welcome. Now, it's 8 p.m., and you're going to groove like a local. Yep, Northeast Portland has at least two extraordinary options for live music. Follow Northeast Killingsworth Street, a mile further west from Farrell, and you'll land at Turn, 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 a beloved down-home space where much local talent has cut its teeth. Saturday night shows often include four or five bands you'll almost surely not have heard of before, but will now make you sound like a true Portlander at parties. Door covers ranges from $5 to $15. For a show, you might be able to sing along as well. There's Mississippi Studios, an intimate space in a former Baptist church. That's only a 10-minute drive away. The best spot in the balcony, where seats fill up fast. Past acts have included the likes of Ben Queller, Illuminati Hotties, Iron and Wine, and Jenny Owens Young. And the ticket prices usually stay around $25. Well, we have enjoyed Saturday night, and we take a break. Now we head into Sunday morning, and it's Cascada Thermal Springs and Spa at 10:30. We're going to soak it in. For breakfast, go to Hardy at the Food at the Dawnbringer, whose English muffin sandwich for $11 shines thanks to slow caramelized grains, or light at Karaoke Bowls with a fruit-filled acai bowl starting at $12. Now, either is the perfect pregame for a soak at Cascada. Thermal Springs and Spa. Now, this is a brand new wellness-themed hotel, a 20-minute drive from the airport. Silent, phone-free underground baths are a remedy for the busyness of travel. Explore the saunas and pools before braving the cold plunge of or exfoliating the crushed ice. The $100 pass offers 3 hours of spa access, including the social upstairs pool. Plenty of time to let everything soak in before you take off. Wow. I'm telling you, they have an interesting lifestyle there in Portland, do they not? Well, anyway, did you know that 99.999% of the deep sea is a mystery? Well, that is the title of Andrew Lewis's article in the September 2025 issue of National Geographic. He tells us about scientist Katie Croft Bell and her mission to make the deep sea less mysterious by deploying a new tool to help scientists get the eyes on the murky depths. Are you ready for that one? Here we go. By the way, it comes with a little disclosure at the start. Reporting in this article is presented by the National Geographic Society in partnership with Rolex under the National Geographic and Rolex Perpetual Planet Ocean Expeditions. We know almost nothing about the deep sea floor after decades of exploration. It is still the least understood habitat on Earth. This blind spot has long vexed National Geographic explorer Katie Croft Bell, who has led dozens of ocean expeditions around the world. After all, the deep sea encompasses some two-thirds of the globe and plays a key role in sequestering carbon and regulating the climate. So Bell and a few other researchers recently set out to quantify the gaps in our knowledge. The results were even worse than they thought. A mere 0.001% of the deep sea floor has been visually observed. They found that though there have been some 44,000 deep sea dives since the 1950s, many surveyed the same sites, resulting in only about 12,000 unique locations explored. Their findings also reveal that just 5 high-income countries have been responsible for nearly all the dives. The cost of a deep-sea research is partly to blame for this monopoly. The price of an advanced tool like a deep submergence vehicle ranges from tens of thousands to millions of dollars. For almost a decade, Bell has been working to make the deep sea more accessible. Her pace picked up in 2018 when she convened nearly 250 researchers at the MIT Media Lab to discuss ways to increase our knowledge of the seafloor. From the cheaper sensors and machine learning to community engagement and robotics. And by the way, Bell had a realization. She said, why couldn't one piece of technology be cheap to make and easy to operate and suited for a wide variety of vessels? Well, that could transform the field, Bell recalls thinking, and really accelerate our understanding of the deep ocean. The veteran ocean researcher decided to make it a reality. So we fast forward 7 years, and Bell is on the cusp of debuting a revolutionary deep submergence vehicle that has many features of the multi-million-dollar devices, but at a cost of less than $10,000. It will be a total game changer, Bell says, not much bigger than a scuba tank. The tool's being built to withstand the immense pressure that exists 20,000 feet below the water's surface, allowing it to reach 98% of the ocean floor. So stay tuned, because I am sure we're going to have some more stories evolving from Katie Bell's research. Thank you so much for listening to Armchair Traveler today. And that concludes our journey for today's episode. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. I remind you, the content of our program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreading.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.